Good morning and good afternoon to everyone. Once again, my name is Zvi Grummet. This is the second of a three-part series on the poetry of destruction. Last week we took a look at Megillat Eicha, and particularly at the first perek of Megillat Eicha. We took a look at the way the author of certainly that perek wove many, many different poetic forms into the perek itself, whether it's through the Aleph Beit construction, whether it was through the switching of the first person and the third person between the first half of the perek and the third and the second half of the perek. There are other elements there that we did not get to look at, but we're going to leave that as Eicha. And what I'd like to do in today's session is move on, because truth is, the poetry of destruction doesn't really end with Eicha. As we know, when on Tisha B'Av, both during the night and during the day, at nighttime, most kehilot have the minhag to read the Megillah of Eicha. During the daytime, there are some that do have that minhag, but most, I think, or many, do not have the minhag. But they continue after the reading of Eicha. It's followed up by the recitation of keynote. Now, I have very strong memories of reciting keynote as a youngster. I would as a preteen or a teen, and we would be sitting in shul, and they took out these books, these little pamphlets, and that things printed on them, more words than I ever imagined. People mumbling through them, and in an hour and a half, they got through the whole thing. I got through maybe 10%, as they rushed through it, and that was my experience of the keynote. As the years went on, I was exposed to other minhagim about saying the keynote. I recall very, very, very powerfully hearing Rav Soloveitchik one time. I was fortunate to hear him one time. Rav Soloveitchik started a custom in which he would say keynote in the morning, start in the morning in his shul in Boston. He would say the keynote, but explain them and give shiurim on the keynote themselves, going throughout the day. And throughout the day, literally from the morning until it was time to daven mincha. And they would say all the keynote. One of the things that he spoke about with a tremendous amount of passion was the fact that growing up in Europe, so the keynote were printed on this flimsy paper. After Tisha B'Av, they would gather them all together and put them into Gniza. We're not going to need them again. And the next year, when inevitably they needed them again, they would take them out of the Gniza and bring them out. So they had these things that were falling apart over the course of many years. And he bemoaned the fact that people were starting to publish books of keynote that had nice translations and with nice layout in them and hardcover meant to last for many, many years. The great irony, of course, is that his own commentary on the keynote was eventually published in a hardcover book, published by Koren. They put this out a number of years ago. The Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, Eicha and Keynote. I'm not sure that he would be so happy about joining that illustrious group of people who are published in hardcover on Keynote. But anyway, over the course of the years, I've had opportunities to learn with a number of people. There was one time to Rabbi Soloveitchik. I learned for a number of years with Rabbi J.J. Schachter, and that sort of inspired me to spend my own time and doing my own investigations of the keynote. So what I thought we would do in today's session, we have two sessions, but I thought we'd do in today's session is take a look at the keynote from that are recited at nighttime. There is a very small list. It's five keynote that are recited at nighttime. On most years, it's actually only four. One of them is said only when Tisha B'Av comes out on a Motzei Shabbat. So I'd like to look at some of those and again to look at them through the eyes of the poetry and what the poet is actually trying to accomplish. I'd like to take a look at three of those in today's session. And then next week we're going to take a look at some of the keynote from from the daytime, and then we'll learn through some of those as well. Okay, just a little bit of a little bit of background. When Chazal talk about Megillat Eicha, they actually don't talk. They don't call it Megillat Eicha. They call it Sefer HaKinot. That was their original name. Lamentations, literally lamenting something that happened. And what began to happen over the course of time, and we know this from the Mishnah. The Mishnah speaks about the fact that over the course of time, we associate Tisha B'Av with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but then became associated with this destruction of two Batei HaMikdash. And then there were other things that got added in over the course of time. Chazal identify five things that happened on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz and five things that happened on Tisha B'Av. And of course, post Chazal, there are other events that got sort of added on to there. One of the most famous is the expulsions from Spain in 1492. We know this from the personal testimony of the Abarbanel, that the date for the expulsions from Spain, the final date for the expulsion was Tisha B'Av, and he writes about it. So over the course of the years, many tragedies have been dumped onto Tisha B'Av, even if they didn't actually happen on Tisha B'Av, but they got dumped onto Tisha B'Av. And Tisha B'Av became a day for mourning multiple tragedies, regardless of when they happened in the course of the year. So that we have keynote that were written, for example, for the Crusades, keynote that were written for the burning of the Talmud in Paris, keynote for the Khmelnytsky massacres. There were keynote over the course of the last 50 years. There have been keynote written for the Shoah. Some of them have actually been published in some of the books, but there's actually a much more extensive collection of keynote that were written for the Shoah that is not as well known. People actually started, even in the course of the last few months, people have started writing keynote for the massacre and the tragedy of October the 7th. I happen to be holding one of those in my hand, one that was written very, very recently. Maybe we'll have a chance to take a look at it, not today, but next week. So keynote became a collection of lots and lots of elegies that had been written, lamentations that had been written over the course of the years. The earliest of the keynote were written by Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, and we'll speak a little bit more about him next week when we focus. When we speak about the keynote for the daytime, because he's associated with many of those, but it's good to know that what we have is a collection, and it's a living collection, meaning it's some of them got published in hardcover and soft cover and whatever it is, but unfortunately, our history has taught us that it's a living collection. It keeps growing. So we're going to take a look at three of them today. The three that are recited at night. They're very different from each other. They're very different poetic styles and very different messages and ideas. For those of you who I sent in the source sheets to the Torah in Motion office. I don't know if they actually got were made accessible to you. If so, I will have all the source sheets up on the screen. I'm gonna close the screen in just a minute and start the screen sharing. It's there, and my guess is that if it's not available to you immediately and you want to look at some of these things afterwards, so everything that I have here on the screen, you will have access to on those source sheets when they do become available. Okay. As we did last week, I'm going to request that we hold the questions until the end. If you want to ask a question, put it into the chat box. I'll take a look at it at the end of the session. At one point, I will actually invite people to respond to a prompt. And we will respond in the chat box. I think it'll make things a lot easier. But without further ado, let's dive into the first of the keynotes that we're going to take a look at. Okay, and I as you'll see in a second, I've actually marked these up, and you'll get to see exactly what I'm talking about with nice colors and things like that. Okay. So by now you should be able to see something on your screens, I'm hoping. The complete source sheets actually have a full translation. I'm covering over the translation because I actually wanted to show you two things in parallel to each other. The kina that you see in front of you on the left side of the screen, identified as kina number one. In many of the books, they have them numbered, and they have all sorts of other ways of referencing them. But the numbering over here is again from that collection from Rav Soloveitchik. It's called the Lukstein edition, in honor of Rabbi Haskel Lukstein from the KJ Shul in Manhattan. So that's the numbering. Just and everything here is basically images taken from that edition. So we have here the first of the keynote, and the first of these keynotes is actually very old. I don't know exactly how old, but it's clear that it's very old. And the style of the keynote, you'll see this in just a moment. The style is almost like a classical midrashic style, and that's one of the clues that it probably is a very, very old kina. On the left-hand side of the screen, you see the kina itself. Let's try to ignore for a minute all the colors that I put up there, but you'll see that on the left-hand side. So you have Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu. Okay, that's the opening of the kina. And if you take a look at the right side of your screen, you'll see I have over here Echa Perek Hey. Okay? Echa Perek Hey, as I pointed out last week, is the only one of the prakim that is not based on an aleph bet. It keeps the structure in that it has 22. Okay, and I'm gonna just ask that, for people to mute themselves, so we don't have unfortunate accidents over here. So this is the fifth parak of Eicha, and if you take a look at the first line of the kina, and this is the first kina that's recited at night, meaning immediately after finishing reading Megillat Eicha, Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu. And if you take a look at the right-hand side of the screen, you'll see that it says exactly the same words, Zechor Hashem Mehayalanu. And that gives us a clue as to what this kina is already beginning to do. Okay? So what I'd like to do is I'd like to start by just reading the first two lines of the Kina, Zechor Hashem mehayalanu. Oy. That word, oy, is the midrash. It's a midrash on Megillat Eicha itself. So that the Kina starts, we just finished the fifth perek, I'm going to start reading it again. But now I'm going to start reading it not as a recitation. Now I'm going to start reading it as something I'm actually saying because I feel it from the inside. And the first word that we hear coming out of the author's mouth, this is the poetry, Zechor Hashem mehayalanu, and he can't even finish the sentence. Oy. And after that groan of oy, he continues with Habita ure'eyet cherpatenu. Look at us and look at our disgrace. I'm trying to figure out how to highlight this without messing things up. I'm having a hard time with that. Okay, let's see. No, I can't do that. Okay, I'm just going to leave it as it is. That second line is the end of Pasuk Aleph of Echa Perek Hey. Habita ure'eyet cherpatenu is the same exact words. So we have over here is the opening line of his kina. He says, "We just finished Perek Hey. I'm going to say it again. I'm just saying Perek Hey again." But now it comes with oy after the first half of pasuk, and then habita ure'eyet cherpatenu, the second half of the pasuk, followed by oy mehayalanu. Look what happened to us. And that's where this starts. Okay? That same thing continues, that same pattern continues into the second line of the Kina. Nachlatenu nefcha lezarim on the left-hand side. Right? Nachlatenu nefcha lezarim. Oy. And that's exactly Pasuk Beit. That's the opening of Pasuk Beit. And then he continues and finishes the Pasuk. Batenu lenochrim. Oy, mehayalanu. You can imagine, right, as the poet not just writing this, but I can imagine the poet reading this. And many of the poets who wrote the piyutim, right, many of them were also chazanim. So they would write their own poetry and then they would recite it. So he would have finished reading Megillat Eicha, and then he would start all over again. He'd start reading the fifth parak again, and now just he's doing this with the oy and the oy mehayalan. And the same thing continues into the third pasuk. Yitomim hayinu ve'en av. We were orphans, no father. Oy. And that's pasuk gimel. Yitomim hayinu ve'en av. And now, the poet actually begins to make a little bit of a switch. The next word on the next line is imotenu, our mothers, and that's actually the next line in the Megillah itself. So Megillat Eicha says imotenu ka'almanot. And here the poet starts with that imotenu as if he's going to finish Pasuk Gimel, but now he goes and does a switch. Now he inserts his own closing to that pasuk. Imotenu mekonenot b'chodesh av. Our mothers are mourn are saying kinot in the month of Av. Okay? So it starts with the midrash and the midrash basically consists of two phrases, oy and oy mehayalanu, and they become the refrains for this entire kina. But then already when he gets to pasuk gimel, he feels like he needs to move out of that. Imotenu mekonenot b'chodesh. When we continue to the line after that, he continues, meaning every line in his kina matches the opening of every pasuk in Perek Hey. So there are 22 paragraphs here, 22 of these short two-line paragraphs. Every one of them opens with the opening of the corresponding pasuk in the fifth parak of Eicha. Meimenu b'chesef shatinu. We have to pay to drink our own water. That's the opening of pasuk Dalet. You see that in the right-hand side of the screen, right? Meimenu b'chesef shatinu, right? And now the author does something else, and here you see a box that I have highlighted on the left-hand side in red. And what he does over here is he's not just bemoaning what has happened, which is what the Megillat Eicha does, not simply bemoaning what happened, but there is a little bit of self-flagellation. There's a little bit of responsibility. I can't bemoan, says this poet, without understanding or without without accepting responsibility for why it happened. You know why? He says we had to pay for our own money. Well, we had to pay for our own water because we defile the water in the Mikdash. Key, because nisuch hamayim bazimim. We didn't pay enough attention. We acted disgracefully towards the ceremony of nisuch hamayim, which took place in the Beit HaMikdash on Sukkot. It was a once a year thing that was accompanied by a great big party, a Simchat Beit HaShoeva. So by the time we get over here, this is already just Pasuk Dalet. The author started his Midrash by simply going line by line and inserting the ois. Then he finished the Pasuk a little bit differently, Pasuk Gimel. By the time we get to Pasuk Dalet, he has now added a whole new element, kinisucha mayim bazinu, that key. That key is essential over here because this is where he's saying, it's nice to cry about what happened, but we have to take responsibility too. And that continues into the next line as well. Al tzavarenu. Again, pasuk hey on the right-hand side. Al tzavarenu nirdafnu. That's the opening of his next line. So he is showing tremendous fidelity over here to the fifth parak of Eicha, but now, right, his midrash is adding new layers, right? We were chased by our necks. Why? Key, and that's again in the red box. Key, sinat chinam radafnu, because we ran after sinat chinam. We ran after, this baseless hatred. Okay, this continues, and for the next few lines, again, every line starts with the blue boxes, right? Are the ones that correspond directly to Perek Hey in Eicha. So Mitzrayim natanu na'yad, that's pasuk vav, and then he adds, right? Because what he's done over here, for example, when he talks about Nisuch Hamayim Bazinu. So he's actually referring to something that happened towards the end of the Second Temple period, in which there was a debate between the Tzdukim and the Prushim about this ceremony of Nisuch Hamayim. And right, it's pouring a water libation instead of a wine libation. The Tzdukim said it shouldn't happen. The Prushim said it absolutely should happen. And there was a big battle about it. So for a while, when the Tzdukim were in charge of the Beit HaMikdash, the Nisuch HaMayim didn't happen. Right? So he talks about Nisuch HaMayim Bazinu. He's talking now about the second Beit HaMikdash. So what he's doing is he's taking events from the first Beit HaMikdash, right? That's what Megillat Eicha is talking about. And he's updating them, saying, well, in the second Beit HaMikdash, we did stuff too, right? When in the next line, this in the second key box, the second red key, He's again talking about the second Beit HaMikdash, because Chazal, when they try to identify, what were the sins, so the famous list that were given by Chazal, they talk about the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, and Shfichut Damim, right? Idolatry and immoral sexual behavior and murder. The second Beit HaMikdash, they say, was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. So here, the author is already moving, trying to meld the first Beit HaMikdash, which is Megillat Echa, with the commentary on, with the update for the second Beit HaMikdash. He does the same thing in the next line. Mitzrayim Natanu Yad. Oy. Right? The Egyptians, they sent out their hands against us. And then he updates that. V'ashur, the Assyrians, and here they're blending the Assyrians and the Babylonians. So Ashur, Sadanu Kitzayad, they hunted us like hunters. All right? So again, what he's doing is he's updating Megillat Echa for the second Beit HaMikdash as well, and that's his midrash. Okay, that's the next stage of his midrash. When we go down, I'm scrolling down a little bit now toward to the bottom of that page. Avadim mashluvanu. So again, we have the on the right hand side, right pasuk chet, avadim mashluvanu. Slaves have ruled over us. Normally, we should be ruling over slaves, and now the tables have been turned. And again, he goes back to the key, right? And here, before we only had two of them in a row, but here he adds a whole string of them. Ki, shiluach havadim bitalnu. You know why slaves are ruling over us? Because we did not free the slaves the way we were supposed to. It's referring to an incident at the end of in Sefer Yirmiyah. Benafshenu, that we have to literally kill ourselves in order to bring some food. Why? Ki kafatnu me'on yadeinu, because we held back food from, or we held our hands tight when the aniyim came. And these continue, these keys continue, you can see, continues on to the next page, right? And keeps, he keeps going one by one. Here we have, like at the top of the page, Nashim b'Tzion inu, that they sexually abused the women in Tzion. Why? Because we did similar things. Ki eshet ishtim uvezinu, right? They violated the prohibitions against taking another man's wife. And these keep going. He keeps referring to different kinds of things, different kinds of sins that the Torah talks about. And this becomes really the central, these keys become the central part of this kina. So this kina moves from the recitation to the oi to ki, responsibility. Okay? I just wanted to point out that it's fascinating that the poet over here gets to personal responsibility so quickly, and this is the first of the keynote that we say at night. The keynote in the morning are very, very different. Personal responsibility doesn't happen until you get very, very deep into the keynote of the morning. And again, we'll see some of that next week. The kina ends again with a bunch of keys, right? So he introduced the keys already by the fifth line, but now we saw that the keys that I outlined in red really form the bulk of the center of the kina, and the closing of the kina takes us to a different place altogether. He continues by using the word key, but here the key actually takes on a very different meaning. And I'd like to take a look at these. So I'm looking at the one that says, Shavat Mesos Libenu. It is five from the bottom. Shavat Mitmasos Livenu, and again you see that matches Pasuk Tedvav. Right over here. Shavat Mitmasos Livenu on the right hand side, and I'll try to move them so that they're actually parallel to each other. And he had the Shabbat, the equivalent of that on the left hand side, Shabbat Mesos Libeinu. Here the key takes on a whole new meaning. Right? So he uses the same word, but it switches. Right? Shabbat Mesos Libeinu, that the joy of our hearts has been put to rest, meaning it's taking a break. Right? Literally, joy has taken a sabbatical. Right? Why? It's no longer key. The key is a proof text. Let me prove it to you. Ki nivtulu olei regalim. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. What I mean by the fact that we no longer have the joy in our hearts because we no longer have aliyah regel. That same new meaning for ki continues. Nafla ateret boshenu, the crown from our head has fallen. Ki, not why, but I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to demonstrate it to you. Let me explain to you what I mean that we've lost our crown. Ki nisraf beit mikdashenu. Al ze hayada velibenu, for this our hearts cry. Ki nutal kavod beit mavayenu, because the honor, the glory of the house that we all wish for has been taken away. Al Har Tzion Sheshameim, ki, and again, let me explain to you what I mean, that Har Tzion is desolate. Nitan alav shikus mishomeim, that they placed there a destructive and disgusting idol. Okay. And this brings us to really close to the end of the perek. He's been going line by line. So the last two lines that we saw are Al Zehaya and Al Har Tzion. And if you take a look at the right-hand side of the screen, you'll see Pasuk Yud Zayin, Al Zehaya Daveli Benu, and then Al Har Tzion Sheshamein, right? And then we get to the last four lines of the perek. And look at what he does in the last four lines of the perek. The last four lines of the perek, he simply copies them. Meaning, all I'm doing is reciting Eicha and adding a little bit of explanation, but I'm going to close by just sticking with the words of Eicha. So in that large blue box, the first four lines there match one for one completely the last four lines of Perek Hey. He started by saying, Oi. He closes by saying, I no longer have anything to Oi for. And just recites the psukim, as they are. So this is a midrash that builds on Eicha and then just concludes with back to Eicha. Okay. And this is one kind of the poetry. I like to call it the Midrash poetry. I don't know if that's a technical name for it. But that's what he does here. Before we move on to the next kina, I wanted to ask a question. I'm going to stop the share on the screen for a minute. I'm going to ask a question and invite everybody who'd like to open up the chat and just to put their answer into the chat. And this is going to introduce us to the next, really to the next of the keynote. If I were to ask you what you think was the worst tragedy, and worst tragedy, let's say, using objective terms numerically, the worst tragedy to ever befall Am Yisrael in all of our history. What would you say that was?
The Holocaust.
Okay, so I see a number of people have written the Shoah. See Qurban HaBayit. So Holocaust, Shoah, that keeps coming up again and again. Not surprising, right? You talk about the Shoah, we talk about a third of our people who were literally obliterated. There are people who try to compare the Shoah and the Qurban. They debate the first Beit HaMikdash or the second Beit HaMikdash. I see first temple destruction coming up over here, generational. The Churban is the paradigm. It turns out that if we speak purely from in numerical terms, there was a tragedy that was greater than the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, greater than the second Churban, numerically worse than the Shoah. And shockingly, it is not in our consciousness at all. Churban HaBayit has a day and a lot of literature devoted to it. The Shoah in modern times has a day and a lot of literature devoted to it. And this other event that numerically was far worse than all the others doesn't have a day, is not part of our consciousness. I would venture to say that in all of Jewish liturgy, it is mentioned only twice. And the twice that it's mentioned are buried in the keynote of Tisha B'Av. So I'd like one of those keynotes is one that we say at nighttime on Tisha B'Av. And I see that someone actually referred to this, and that is the destruction of the Northern Kingdom. 135 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the Kingdom of Yehuda, the Northern Kingdom was exiled. We talk about the 10 lost tribes. So if you want to talk numerically, we're talking somewhere in the range of 80% of our people. And they are not in our consciousness, and the destruction of that is not present in our conscious in our consciousness. What's interesting is that the author of Sefer Melachim devoted a very long perek to mourn for the destruction of the Northern Kingdom. Much more, he gave that much more real estate than the biblical real estate than he gave to the destruction, or certainly to the mourning of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the Kingdom of Yehuda, which is really striking, considering that according to Chazal, it was Yirmiyahu HaNavi. So Yirmiyahu HaNavi, the same one who wrote Eicha, and the same one who tried preventing Churban HaBayit, and was unsuccessful, devoted his entire life and suffered tremendously because of it. That according to Chazal, he's the one who mourned the destruction of the Northern Kingdom even more than he mourned the destruction of the Kingdom of Yehuda. Once I became aware of this about 5 or 6 years ago, I never ceased to be amazed at how the destruction of the Kingdom of Israel really has no place in our consciousness. It's not mentioned. We don't do anything about it. I understand why that happened. And yet, despite the fact that I understand why that happened, I think it's worthwhile devoting some time to focusing on that. And that's exactly the topic of the next kina. So I'd like to go, and I'm going to again share my screen with you, and we're going to learn a kinah that speaks specifically about that. I venture to say that this kinah, and we're about to see it in a minute, just as soon as I adjust my screen so we can get an English translation up here as well. This kinah is one of what I would call, in contemporary terms, the most Jewish of kinot. What I mean by that is that the kinah is written as a dialogue, or actually a debate, between two cities. One city is Shomron. Shomron was the capital of the kingdom of Yisrael, the last capital, and Yerushalayim, the capital of the kingdom of Yehuda. And the debate basically is who suffered more. And I can imagine two old people sitting and talking to each other. You wouldn't believe what happened to me. And the other one says, "Oy vey, that sounds terrible." But once you hear what happened to me, right? I mean, the back and forth there. It's the way I imagine, typical Jewish conversations over the years. Oh, my suffering was worse than, no, your suffering was bad, but mine was so much worse. Okay. This is the kinah. The kinah is the debate between Yerushalayim and Shomron as to who suffered more. Okay. They're given nicknames. Nicknames are based on Yechezkel, where Yerushalayim is called Aholivah, and I've highlighted Aholivah in green. They have the green boxes. And Shomron is called Ahola. Okay, obviously they're similar. Ahola meaning the tent, and Aholivah meaning my tent is there, right? Meaning God saying my tent is there, meaning the Beit HaMikdash. So Yerushalayim is Aholivah, and Shomron is Ahola. And let's just take a few minutes to read through, just slowly. And this is the poetry here. This is the poetry of personification, similar to what we saw in the first parak of Eicha. And here is the author is giving voice to two cities, and the two cities are talking. All right. And here we go. This kinah was written, I believe, by Rav Shlomo Ibn Gvirol. Shomron kol titenem, right at the top of the page. Okay. And you should have the English translation right parallel to it. Shomron kol titen mitzauni avonai. Shomron cries out, my sins have caught up with me. La'eretz acheret yitzauni. They took my children and they've been exiled to a foreign land. V'aholivah tizak. Aholivah cries out, Nisrefu armonai, my palaces have been burnt. Vatomer tzion azavani Hashem. And Tzion cries out that God has abandoned me. This, by the way, is from Yeshaya. It is one of the haftarot that we say, it's the opening of one of the haftarot that we say after Tisha B'Av. We have a series of seven haftarot of consolation. That's the opening line. And now we have Shomron's argument. Shomron's argument reads like this: Lo lach Aholivah, chashov onyech ko'ani. No, not you, Aholivah. Shomron turns to Yerushalayim and says, don't think that your suffering is like mine. Hatim sheli shivrech l'shivri. You're going to compare your suffering to mine? Ani Ahola, me, Ahola, meaning Shomron, Sura Bagadati Bikoshi, I strayed, right? And I rebelled against, against God. V'kam alai kachashi v'anavi meriyi. And my lying, my deceitful way of behaving myself, my rebellious ways came back to haunt me. Ulemiftsat hayamin. And after a short amount of time, because right, the kingdom of of Israel did not last all that long. The kingdom of Yehuda lasted, we know, for 420 years, 410, 420 years. The kingdom of Israel wasn't founded until about 80 years after the kingdom of Yehuda, and was destroyed 135 years beforehand. So the length of its time that it actually stood was only about half. So he says the Mikzat Hayamim, after only a short amount of time, Shilamti Neshia, I had to pay off my debt. V'tiglat Pileser, and the Assyrian king, Achalet Piryi, came and devoured my fruit, my children. Chamudotai Hifshit, he took all of my treasures. He stripped me bare of all my treasures. V'yitzilat Edi, took all my jewels. V'lachalach V'chavor, those are names of two cities that we know were important stops on the way towards the Assyrian exile. Okay, and this is 135 years before the destruction of the kingdom of Yehuda. So Lachalach to Chalach and Chavor, Nasa et Shivi, he took my captives. So therefore, Domi, Oliva, oh shut up, Oliva, like Domi, be still, be quiet, shut up. Domi, Oliva, Al Tivki Kivichi, you should not cry like I cry. Shnotayich Archu. Your years, you at least lived a long life. Below Archu Shanai, but my years not. Right? So here we have Shomron crying. I didn't get to be around that long. I paid the price. I died at a very young age. And then we have the refrain from that we saw up above. What would Aholivah's Yerushalayim's response be? But my palaces were burnt. And now we get to the second key paragraph. The second key paragraph is Aholivah's real response. This is the extended response. Mishiva Aholivah. This is where Aholivah Yerushalayim responds. Ani kein akashti. Yes, I too was very stubborn. Uva'aluf ne'urai batadati. And like you, Ahola, I also rebelled against the champion of my youth, right? The love of my youth. But domi Ahola, but you, Ahola, should shut up. And here you see what's interesting is that using the same exact word, I highlighted it in red. I underlined it in red. But Aholah said that to Aholivah, and now Aholivah is saying that back to Aholah. You told me to shut up? No, you're the one who needs to be quiet, right? This, by the way, is really interesting because it actually mirrors something that comes up in Shir HaShirim, where in Shir HaShirim you basically have two star-crossed lovers, and what happens is one describes the other using incredibly superlatives and wonderful terms, and then soon afterwards you find the second one describing the first one using terms that are very, very similar. So here you have the parallel to that, right? That was in a love story, and here we have in a competition for who suffers more, right? So here, whereas Aholah had said to Aholivah, "Domi, you be quiet." Now Aholivah says back, "No, you be quiet." Kiyegonizacharti. Now I remember my anguish, or I'm remembering my anguish. Nadadati atachat. You went into exile once. Rabot nadadati, but I went into exile many times. Right? Hinei biyat kasdim pa'amayim nilkadati. Twice I was captured by the Babylonians. And what this is referring to is about 25 years. I don't remember the exact timing, but about 25 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the kingdom of Yehuda, the Babylonian king came, and he was already he had already conquered this entire part of the world. He removed the Judean king, he took him and replaced him with one of with somebody else from the royal family that he thought would be loyal to him. Replaced him with somebody called Jehoiachin. We also know him as Yechoniah. Some of you may recognize that name from Megillat Esther. Right? Mordechai was a descendant of those who were exiled, Asher Hogla, Asher Hogla Nebuchadnezzar, Im Yechoniah Melech Yehuda. Right? Meaning he was exiled together with Yechoniah. What was the story there? Nebuchadnezzar had come. He had removed the Judean king. He placed Jehoiachin in charge. And presumably Jehoiachin was supposed to be loyal to him. But after a number of years, because of Jehoiachin's own reasoning, including a lot of internal politics, Jehoiachin decided that he was no longer going to be loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar came and he took the entire royal family and the entire cultural elite. Anybody who had money, anybody who had power, anybody who was close to the ruling authorities, he took them all en masse and carted them off to Babel and left behind the poor people, left behind those who are not politically connected, left behind those who didn't have any kind of power or authority. And that way, they would probably be more pliable and less prepared to rebel against him. In the meantime, Yechoniah and the people he took, they had gone into exile. There's a lot to talk about that exile because it wasn't a typical exile. But that's what he's referring to twice, right? So in the second large paragraph, the third line, Hinei biyad kasdim pa'amayim nilkadeti. I was trapped or captured twice by the Babylonians. Once referring to the exile of Yechoniah, which was the exile of the elite, and the second was the exile that took place that we all know about that involved the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So there were two exiles. Ushviya va'aniya levavel yaradati. So I was broken and a captive and poor, and I went down to Babel. V'nisraf ha'echal asher bo nechbadati. The one thing that I had, right, the one thing that the kingdom of Yehuda had. It wasn't very large. It wasn't very powerful for much of its time, but the one thing it didn't have was the Beit HaMikdash. So that was burnt. Uli shivim shana bevavel nifkadeti. And after 70 years, I actually came back. So I was exiled twice. I came back. I had another chance. V'shavti l'tzion od v'heichal. So I came back and I rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash. But gamzot hapam ma'at lo amadeti. And this time also, I stood for not an inconsequential amount of time, ad lekachani Edom, until the next, right, and until the Romans came along, and they exiled me. Bechimat avadati, I was almost completely destroyed then. We were taken off into, sold as slaves and carted off to Europe, and the alkol ha'aratzot nafotsu hamonai. So I was taken. My people was spread all over the place. So we have this very, very Jewish conversation going on over here. This debate between Yerushalayim and Shomron, who suffers more? And they get equal space over here. And at the bottom, the author now reflects on this. Achomel Aldal. The one, you God who pities the poor, chamol al dalutam, please have pity on their plight. Okay? And it's not clear, is he referring only to Aholivah, only to Yerushalayim, or is he referring to both? Right? This kina
Thanks.
is probably the only full expression of mourning for the Northern Kingdom that we have in our liturgy. And is one of the keynote that we say at night, is one of the few that we say at night. And I thought it would be valuable for us to be able to see this. And again, the poetry involved is the poetry of giving voice to the two cities. Okay, I'm looking at the clock now, and I see that we only have about literally about 5 minutes left. I'm just going to take literally just 2 minutes to speak about the fifth kina, which is the last one that we say at night. And then I'll take a look at the chat and see what questions have come up and respond to them. This is the last of the keynote. What I highlighted here in green, what this kina describes, it talks about the 12 tribes. If you take a look at the third line, Gam Bachu B'Merar Shivtei Yaakov, the 12 tribes. And then in the green, Va'af Mazalot Yizlu Dima, the constellations. The constellations are crying. And this entire kina basically goes through the 12 constellations and describes how, talks about each one of them and each one of the green highlighted boxes over here. And again, if you get those source sheets, you'll have this, and you'll have this to reference. Talks about each one of them. So you have Kima and Ksil, which are constellations. One of them is Orion. Talks about Tzva HaShamayim, like the heavenly hosts. Talks about the sun and the moon, Shemesh, Yareach, Kochavim, Mazalot. Here he goes to Taleh, Aries the ram. And he goes to Ashur, Taurus the bull. Ta'omim, twins, Gemini. Sartan, Cancer. Aryeh, Leo. Betula, Virgo. Moznayim, Libra, the scales. Akrav is Scorpio. Keshet is Sagittarius, the archer. We got a few more. We have the water of Aquarius, Dli. We have the goat, Capricorn, Gdi, and we have Dagim, okay, fish, Pisces. So we have all the constellations over here. He talks about how the constellations are crying. The significance of this kina, again, aside from the poetry involved, there's something that goes beyond talking about the constellations, because in the ancient world, the constellations were what they were, the world. They were the universe. People understood them as the things that either determined or influenced or reflected what was happening in the world as we know it. And what this kina is basically saying is that the destruction of the kingdom of Yehuda and the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash were events that affected not only the Jewish people. These were events that had cosmic significance. They affected everybody in the world. Not only everybody in the world, they affected everything in the world. The same way, it's sort of the mirror image of Kriyat Yamsuf. And one of the keynote that we say in the morning actually parallels or contrasts leaving Mitzrayim to leaving Yerushalayim. But the leaving Mitzrayim and Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, so the Shira that they say there actually highlights that the understanding that that was an event that affected not only the Jewish people, it affected everything in the universe. It affected all the nations on the planet. The Midrashim talk about how the water every place in the world split, not just Kriyat Yamsuf, right? They're trying to make a point over here. This was an event of cosmic significance. Well, here, this is the final one of the final kina for the nighttime, and it's trying to highlight that just like Kriyat Yam Suf was of cosmic significance, so too was the destruction of the kingdom of Yehuda and the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It was not something that affected only Am Yisrael. It affected everything in the universe. It affected God. Everything. So today we took a look at three keynote. This one very, very briefly. The first one that we saw really was a midrash on the last perek of Echa. The second one that we saw was the debate between Yerushalayim and Shomron. And the third one, this one over here, talks about the cosmic significance of Tisha B'Av and the events associated with it. And now I'm just going to open up. So there are three comments here at the end. Matovu Oholecha Yaakov, this is verse of Bilam, the source of the identity of Shomron. That's an excellent question. I don't know. I don't know. I think that the source actually comes from Yechezkel. There's a perek in Yechezkel where Yechezkel actually, I think he was the one who first identified Ahola as a term to describe Shomron and Aholivah as describing Yerushalayim. Was this Kina written by Ibn Ezra? So I don't think we know who wrote this final Kina. It's probably, at least according to the sources that I'm familiar with, it's much, much older than Ibn Ezra. I would venture to guess that it probably dates back to the Babylonian period. The Babylonian religion, Persian religion, Zoroastrianism, was very, very much tied in with the constellations. Chazal and the Gemara talk about it, and it was very popular in Babel. So if I had to guess, and it's only a guess, I would guess that this was a Kina that was written in Bavel, where those influences were very, very powerful. And the last comment over here, I wish you could give this in the Knesset. I'm assuming you're talking about the debate between who's suffering more and the need for all of us, but really all.
And also taking responsibility for
Taking
some of the
responsibility.
things that have happened.
Yeah.
It's very current, very current.
I'm gonna let you. I'm gonna stay away from politics. I'll let you draw your own political conclusions for each of these things. There's obviously a lot that was written a long time ago that is still very, very relevant to us today. Okay, so I went a few minutes over time. My apologies for that. And next week, we're going to focus on two or three of the keynote that we say in the morning.
Thank you. Tzvi, can I ask you one more question?
Course.
Sure. So I never realized this before, but the author of Eicha, let's say it's Yirmiyahu, he's quoting Hosea in that line of Shavat Misos Libenu, and then the addition of Niftalu Olei Regalenu. That's Hosea chapter 2, verse 13. When he
Wow.
talks Hishbati Kol Misosa, Kol Kocha Vishabata V'Chol Moadeha.
Yep.
I'm struck by that.
It would not be the first time that we have Nevi'im that
Oh, yeah.
borrow language from other Nevi'im.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the room now, and I look forward to seeing you next week. And Asher, you were right on target with your comment there earlier when you spoke about the Northern Kingdom.